that any magistrate would uphold the right of a man to his wife and child, regardless of the wife's feeling in the matter. His own parents had wed by such device, fleeing and hiding among the Highland crags until his mother was well with child, so that her brothers were forced to accept the unwelcome marriage. A child was a permanent, undeniable bond between man and woman, and he had cause to know it. He glanced toward the path that came up through the lower wood.
"Will he not be here on your heels? The Woolhams will have told him the way."
"No," said Ian thoughtfully. "I shouldn't think so. We took his horse, aye?"
He grinned suddenly at Lizzie, who giggled faintly in reply.
"Aye, I watched to stop him taking the wagon or one of the wagon mules."
The grin widened substantially on Ian's face.
"I left Rollo in the wagon bed," he said. "I think he'll walk it, Uncle Jamie."
Jamie was forced to a grudging smile in return.
"That was quick of you, Ian."
Ian shrugged modestly.
"Well, I didn't want the bastard to take us unawares. And though I've not heard Cousin Brianna talk about her laddie lately, yon Wakefield, aye?"
He paused delicately.
"I didn't think she'd want to see this Mackenzie, especially if, I should say, Mr. Wakefield has left his coming o'er long," Jamie said. "Especially if."
It was no wonder she'd stopped looking forward to Wakefield's coming, once she'd realized. After all, how would a woman explain a swelling belly to a man who'd left her a virgin? He slowly and consciously unclenched his fists. There would be time enough for all that later. For the moment, there was the one thing to be dealt with.
"Fetch my pistols from the house," he said, turning to Ian. "And you, lassie."
He gave Lizzie something intended for a smile, and reached for the coat he'd hung on the edge of the woodpile.
"Bide ye here, and wait for your mistress. Tell my wife, tell her I've gone to give Fergus a hand with his chimney. And dinna speak a word about this to my wife or daughter, or I'll have your guts for garters."
This last threat was spoken half in jest, but the girl went white as though he'd meant it literally. Lizzie sank down on the chopping block, her knees wobbling beneath her. She fumbled for the tiny medallion at her neck, seeking reassurance from the cold metal. She watched Mr. Fraser stride down the path, menacing as a great red wolf. His shadow stretched out black before him, and the late autumn sun touched him with fire. The medal in her hand was cold as ice.
"Oh, dear mother," she murmured over and over. "Oh, blessed mother, what have I done?"
Chapter 45. 50-50. The oak leaves were dry and crackling underfoot. There was a constant fall of leaves from the chestnut trees that towered overhead, a slow yellow rain that mocked the dryness of the ground.
"Is it true that Indians can move through the woods without making a sound? Or is that just something they tell you in Girl Scouts?"
Brianna kicked at a small drift of oak leaves, sending them flying. Dressed in wide skirts and petticoats that caught at leaves and twigs, we sounded like a herd of elephants ourselves.
"Well, they can't do it in dry weather like this unless they swing through the trees like chimpanzees. In a wet spring, it's another story. Even I could walk through here quietly then. The ground is like a sponge."
I drew in my skirts to keep them away from a big elderberry bush, and stooped to look at the fruit. It was dark red, but not yet showing the blackish tinge of true ripeness.
"Two more days," I said. "If we were going to use them for medicine, we'd pick them now. I want them for wine, though, and to dry like raisins. And for that, you want them to have a lot of sugar. So you wait until they're nearly ready to drop from their stems."
"Right. What landmark is it?"
Brianna glanced around and smiled.
"No, don't tell me. It's that big rock that looks like an Easter Island head."
"Very good," I said approvingly.
"Right, because it won't change with the seasons."
Reaching the edge of a small stream, we separated, working our way slowly down the banks. I had set Brianna to collect cress while I poked about the trees in search of wood ears and other edible fungi. I watched her covertly as I hunted, one eye on the ground, one on her. She was knee-deep in the stream with her skirts kilted up, showing an amazing stretch of long, muscular thigh as she waded slowly, eyes on the rippling water. There was something wrong. Had been for days. At first I had assumed her air of tension was due to the obvious stresses of the new situation in which she found herself. But over the past weeks, she and Jamie had settled into a relationship that, while still marked by shyness on both sides, was increasingly warm. They delighted each other, and I was delighted to see them together. Still, there was something troubling her. It had been 3 years since I had left her, 4 since she had left me to live on her own, and she had changed, had grown entirely into a woman now. I could no longer read her as easily as I once had. She had Jamie's trick of hiding strong feeling behind a mask of calmness. I knew it well in both of them. In part, I had arranged this foraging expedition as an excuse to talk to her alone. With Jamie, Ian, and Lizzie in the house, and the constant traffic of tenants and visitors come to see Jamie, private conversation there was impossible. And if what I suspected was true, this wasn't a conversation I wished to have where anyone could hear. By the time I had my basket half filled with thick, fleshy orange wood ears, Brianna had emerged dripping from the stream, her own basket overflowing with clumps of wet green cress and bunches of jointed horsetail reeds to make into tapers. She wiped her feet on the hem of her petticoat and came to join me under one of the huge chestnut trees. I handed her the canteen of cider and waited till she had had a drink. "Is it Roger?" I said then, without preliminary. She glanced at me, a flash of startlement visible in her eyes, and then I saw the tense line of her shoulder ease. "I wondered whether you could still do that," she said.
"Do what?"
"Read my mind. I sort of hoped you could." Her wide mouth quirked awkwardly, trying to smile.
"I expect I'm a bit out of practice," I said, "but give me a moment."
I reached up and smoothed the hair off her face. She looked at me, but beyond me, too shy to meet my eyes. A whippoorwill called in the far green shadows.
"It's all right, baby," I said quietly. "How far gone are you?"
The breath left her in a huge sigh. Her face went slack with relief.
2 months.
Now she met my eyes, and I felt a small shock of difference, the kind I had been getting since her arrival. Once, her relief would have been a child's, a fear confided and half eased already by the knowledge that I would somehow deal with it. But now, it was only the relief of sharing an unbearable secret. She wasn't expecting me to remedy things. The knowledge that I couldn't do anything in any case didn't stop my irrational feeling of loss. She squeezed my hand, as though reassuring me, and then sat down with her back against a tree trunk, stretching out her legs in front of her, long feet bare.
"Did you know already?"
I sat down next to her, less gracefully.
"I expect so. But I didn't know I knew, if that makes sense."
Looking at her now, it was plain to see. The faint pallor of her skin and tiny alterations in her colour, the fleeting look of inwardness. I had noticed, but had put the changes down to unfamiliarity and strain, to the flurry of emotions over finding me, meeting Jamie, to worry over Lizzie's sickness, worry over Roger. That particular worry now took on a sudden new dimension.
"Oh, Jesus, Roger!"
She nodded, pale in the filtered yellow shade of the chestnut leaves overhead. She looked jaundiced, and no wonder.
"It's been nearly 2 months. He should have been here, unless something happened."
My mind was busy calculating. 2 months, and now it's nearly November.
The leaves under us lay thick and soft, yellow and brown, fresh fallen from the hickory and chestnut trees.
My heart dropped suddenly in my chest. "Bree, you've got to go back."
"What?"
Her head jerked up.
"Go back where?"
"To the stones." I waved a hand in agitation. "To Scotland, and right away." She stared at me, thick brows drawn down.
Now? What for?
I took a deep breath, feeling a dozen different emotions collide. Concern for Bree, fear for Roger, a terrible sorrow for Jamie, who would have to give her up again so soon, and for myself.
You can go through pregnant. We know that much, because I did it, with you.
But, honey, you can't take a baby through that.
You can't, I ended, helpless. You know what it's like.
It had been 3 years since I came through the stones, but I recalled the experience vividly. Her eyes went black as the little blood remaining in her face drained away.
You can't take a child through, I repeated,
trying to get myself under control, think logically.
It would be like jumping off Niagara Falls with the baby in your arms.
You'll have to go back before it's born, or...
I broke off, making calculations.
It's almost November. Ships won't make the passage between late November and March. And you can't wait till March. That would mean making a 2-month trip across the Atlantic, 6 or 7 months pregnant. If you didn't deliver on the ship, which would likely kill you or the baby, or both, you'd still have to ride 30 miles to the Circle and then make the passage. Find your way to help on the other side.
Brianna, you can't do it.
You have to go now, as soon as we can manage.
And if I do go now, how will I make sure I end up in the right time?
She spoke quietly, but her fingers were pleating the fabric of her skirt.
I did, I said, my initial panic beginning to subside into rational thought.
You had Daddy at the other end.
She glanced up at me sharply.
Whether you wanted to go to him or not, you had strong feelings for him. He would have pulled you.
Or me. But he isn't there any more.
Her face tightened, then relaxed.
Roger knows how, she corrected herself. Gilles Duncan's book said you could use gems to travel, for protection and navigation.
But you and Roger are both only guessing, I argued. And so was bloody Gilles Duncan.
You might not need either gemstones or a strong attachment.
In the old fairy tales, when people go inside a fairy's den and then return, it's always 200 years. If that's the usual pattern, then...
Would you risk finding out it's not?
And it's not. Gilles Duncan went further than 200 years.
It occurred to me, a little belatedly, that she'd thought all this out herself. Nothing I was saying came as any surprise. And that meant she had also reached her own conclusion, which did not involve taking the ship back to Scotland. I rubbed a hand between my brows, making an effort to match her calmness. The memory of Gilles had called to mind another memory, though one I'd tried to forget.
"There's another way,"
I said, fighting for calm.
"Another passage, I mean. It's on Haiti. They call it Hispaniola now. In the jungle there are standing stones on a hill, but the crack, the passage, is underneath in a cave."
The forest air was cool, but it wasn't the shadows that made my skin ripple into goose flesh. I rubbed my forearms, trying to erase the chill. I would willingly have erased all memory of the cave of Abandawi as well. I tried, but it wasn't a place easily forgotten.
"You've been there?"
She leaned forward, intent.
"Yes.
It's a horrible place.
But the Indies are a good deal closer than Scotland is, and ships sail between Charleston and Jamaica nearly all year."
I took a deep breath, feeling a little better.
It wouldn't be easy to go through the jungle, but it would give you a little longer, long enough for us to find Roger.
If he could still be found, I thought, but didn't say so. That particular fear could be dealt with later. One of the chestnut leaves spiraled down onto Brianna's lap, vivid yellow against the soft brown homespun, and she picked it off, smoothing the waxy surface absently with her thumb. She looked at me, blue eyes intent.
"Does this place work like the other one?"
"I don't know how any of them work. It sounded different. A bell sound instead of a buzzing noise. But it was a passage, all right."
"You've been there," she said slowly, looking at me under her brows.
"Why? Did you want to go back? After you'd found... him?"
There was still a slight hesitation in her voice. She couldn't quite bring herself to refer to Jamie as...
"My father."
"No. It was to do with Gilles Duncan. She found it."
Brianna's eyes sprang wide.
"She's here?"
"No. She's dead." I took a deep breath, feeling the remembered shock and tingle of an axe blow run up my arm. Sometimes I thought of her, of Gilles, when I was alone in the forest. Sometimes I thought I heard her voice behind me and turned around swiftly, but saw no more than the hemlock branches soughing in the wind. But now and then I felt her eyes on me, green and bright as the springtime wood.
"Quite dead," I said firmly, and changed the subject. "How did this happen, anyway?"
There wasn't any pretense of not knowing what I was talking about. She gave me a straight look, one eyebrow raised.
"You're the doctor. How many ways are there?"
I gave her back the look, with interest.
"Didn't you even think of taking any precautions?"
She glowered, thick brows drawn down.
"I wasn't planning to have sex here."
I clutched my head, digging my fingers into my scalp in exasperation.
"You think people plan it? Good God, how many times did I come to that school of yours and give talks about..."
"All the time. Every year. My mother, the sex encyclopedia.
Do you have any idea how mortifying it is to have your own mother standing up in front of everybody drawing pictures of penises?"
Her face went the colour of scarlet maples, flushed with the memory. "I must not have done it all that well," I said tartly, "since you seem not to have recognised one when you saw it." Her face jerked toward me, blood in her eye, but then relaxed when she saw that I was joking. Or trying to. "Right," she said.
"Well, they look different in 3D.
Taken unawares, I laughed. After a moment's hesitation, she joined me, a hesitant giggle. "You know what I mean. I gave you that prescription before I left." She looked down her long, straight nose at me.
"Yes, and I was never so shocked in my life. You thought I'd run right out and have sex with everybody in sight the minute you left?"
"You're implying that it was only my presence stopping you." The corner of her wide mouth twitched.
"Well, not only that," she conceded, "but you had something to do with it, you and Daddy. I mean, I wouldn't have wanted to disappoint you."
The twitch had turned to a quiver in an instant, and I hugged her hard, her smooth, bright hair against my cheek.
"You couldn't, baby," I murmured, rocking her slightly. "We'd never be disappointed in you. Never."
I felt both tension and worry ebb as I held her. Finally, she took a deep breath and let go of me.
"Maybe not you or Daddy," she said, "but what about..."
She tilted her head toward the now invisible house.
"He won't," I began,
but then stopped. The truth was, I didn't know what Jamie would do. On the one hand, he was strongly inclined to think that Brianna hung the moon. On the other hand, he had opinions regarding sexual honour that could only be described, for obvious reasons, as old-fashioned, and no inhibitions at all about expressing them. He was worldly, well-educated, tolerant and compassionate. This didn't in any way, shape or form, mean that he shared or understood modern sensibilities. I knew quite well he didn't, and I couldn't think that his attitude toward Roger would be tolerant in the slightest.
"Well," I said dubiously,
"I shouldn't wonder if he didn't want to punch Roger in the nose or something. But don't worry," I added, seeing her look of alarm. "He loves you," I said, and smoothed the tumbled hair off her flushed face.
"He won't stop."
I got up, brushing yellow leaves from my skirt.
"We'll have a bit of time then, but none to waste. Jamie can send word downriver to keep an eye out for Roger."
Speaking of Roger... I hesitated, picking a bit of dried fern from my sleeve. I don't suppose he knows about this, does he? Brianna took a deep breath, and her fist closed tight on the leaf in her hand, crushing it.
Well, see, there's a problem about that, she said.
She looked up at me, and suddenly she was my little girl again.
It isn't Roger's.
What? I said stupidly.
It isn't Roger's baby, she said, between clenched teeth.
I sank down beside her once more. Her worry over Roger suddenly took on new dimensions.
Who? I said. Here or there?
Even as I spoke, I was calculating. It had to be someone here, in the past. If it had been a man in her own time, she'd be farther along than 2 months. Not only in the past, then, but here, in the colonies.
I wasn't planning to have sex, she'd said.
No, of course not. She hadn't told Roger for fear he would follow her. He was her anchor, her key to the future. But in that case...
Here, she said, confirming my calculations.
She dug in the pocket of her skirt and came out with something. She reached toward me, and I held out my hand automatically.
Jesus H. Roosevelt Christ!
The worn gold wedding band sparked in the sun, and my hand closed reflexively over it. It was warm from being carried next to her skin, but I felt a deep coldness seep into my fingers.
Bonnet, I said. Stephen Bonnet!
Her throat moved convulsively, and she swallowed, head jerking in a brief nod.
I wasn't going to tell you.
I couldn't. Not after Ian told me about what happened on the river. At first I didn't know what Dar would do. I was afraid he'd blame me. And then, when I knew him a little better, I knew he'd try to find Bonnet. That's what Daddy would have done. I couldn't let him do that. You met that man. You know what he's like.
She was sitting in the sun, but a shudder passed over her, and she rubbed her arms as though she was cold.
I do, I said.
My lips were stiff. Her words were ringing in my ears.
I wasn't planning to have sex. I couldn't tell.
I was afraid he'd blame me.
What did he do to you? I asked,
and was surprised that my voice sounded calm.
Did he hurt you, baby?
She grimaced and pulled her knees up to her chest, hugging them against herself.
Don't call me that, okay?
Not right now. I reached to touch her, but she huddled closer into herself, and I dropped my hand.
Do you want to tell me?
I didn't want to know. I wanted to pretend it hadn't happened, too. She looked up at me, lips tightened to a straight white line.
No, she said.
No, I don't want to.
But I think I'd better.
She had stepped aboard the Gloriana in broad daylight, cautious but feeling safe by reason of the number of people around. Loaders, seamen, merchants, servants. The docks bustled with life. She had told a seaman on the deck what she wanted. He had vanished into the recesses of the ship, and a moment later Stephen Bonnet had appeared. He had on the same clothes as the night before. In the daylight she could see that they were of fine quality, but stained and badly crumpled. Greasy candle wax had dripped on the silk cuff of his coat, and his jabot had crumbs in it. Bonnet himself showed fewer marks of wear than did his clothes. He was fresh-shaven, and his green eyes were pale and alert. They passed over her quickly, lighting with interest.
"I did think ye comely last night by candlelight," he said, taking her hand and raising it to his lips. "But a many seem so when the drink is flowin'. It's a good deal more rare to find a woman fairer in the sun than she is by the moon."
Brianna tried to extract her hand from his grasp, giving him a polite smile.
"Thank you. Do you still have the ring?"
Her heart beat fast in her throat. He could still tell her about the ring, about her mother, even if he had lost it gambling. But she wanted very badly to have it in her hands. she suppressed the fear that had haunted her all night, that the ring might be all that was left of her mother. It couldn't be. Not if the newspaper clipping was right, but...
Oh, indeed. The luck of Donu herself was with me the night, and still is by the looks of it.
He gave her a charming smile, still keeping hold of her hand.
I wondered if you'd sell it to me.
She had brought nearly all the money she had with her, but had no idea what the cost of a gold ring might be.
Why?
The blunt question took her unawares, and she fumbled for an answer.
It looks like one my mother had,
she answered, unable to invent an answer better than the truth.
Where did you get it?
Something moved behind his eyes, though he still smiled at her. He gestured toward the dark companionway and tucked her hand in the crook of his elbow. He was taller than she, a big man. She pulled cautiously, but he held her hand fast.
So, you want the ring? Come down to my cabin, my dear, and we shall see if an accommodation might be reached.
Below, he poured her brandy. She took the barest sip, but he drank deeply, draining one glass and pouring another.
Where? He said carelessly in answer to her persistent questions. Ah, well, a gentleman shouldn't be telling tales of his lady, should he?
He winked at her.
A love token,
he whispered. The smile on her own face felt stiff, and the sip of brandy she had taken burned in her stomach.
The lady who gave it to you, she said. Is she in good health?
He gaped at her, lower jaw fallen slightly open.
Luck, she said hastily. It's bad luck to wear jewellery that belongs to someone who's dead.
Is it?
The smile returned.
I cannot say I've noticed that effect myself.
He set down the glass and gave a slight, pleasurable belch.
Still, I can assure you, the lady from whom I had that ring was both alive and well when I left her.
The burning sensation in her stomach eased slightly.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that. Will you sell it to me, then?
He rocked back in his chair, eyeing her, a small smile on his lips.
Sell it? And what will you offer me, sweetheart?
£15 sterling.
Her heart began to beat faster again as he stood up. He was going to agree.
Where did he keep it?
He stood up, took her hand, and pulled her up out of the chair.
I've enough money, sweetheart, he said. What colour's the hair between your legs?
She jerked her hand out of his grasp and backed up as quickly as she could, slamming into the wall of the cabin within a few steps.
You've mistaken me, she said. I didn't mean...
Maybe not, he said,
and the edges of his teeth showed in his smile.
But I do. And I do think perhaps you've mistaken me, sweetheart.
He took a step toward her. She snatched the brandy bottle from the table and swung it at his head. He ducked adroitly, plucked the bottle from her hand, and slapped her hard across the face. She staggered, half blinded by the sudden pain. He grasped her by the shoulders and forced her to her knees. His fingers twisted tight in her hair, close to the scalp, and jerked her head hard. He held her, head canted at an awkward angle, while he fumbled with the other hand at the front of his breeches. He grunted slightly with satisfaction and took a half step closer, thrusting his hips forward.
"Meet Leroy," he said.
Leroy was both uncircumcised and unwashed, and gave off a powerful smell of stale urine. She felt a bolus of vomit rise in her throat and tried to turn her head away. The answer to that was a vicious yank on her hair that brought her back, stifling a cry of pain.
"Put out that little pink tongue and give us a kiss, sweetheart."
Bonnet sounded cheerful and unconcerned, his grip on her hair tight as ever. She lifted her hand toward him in unspoken protest. He saw it and tightened his grip, making tears start in her eyes. She put out her tongue.
"Not bad, not bad," he said judiciously. "All right, open your mouth."
He let go of her hair quite suddenly, and her head snapped back. Before she could jerk away, he had seized her by one ear, twisting slightly.
"Bite me, sweetheart, and I'll mash your nose flat, eh?"
He brushed his closed fist lightly under her nose, nudging the tip with a massive knuckle. Then he took a firm grip on her other ear, holding her head immobile between his big hands. She concentrated on the taste of blood from her cut lip, the taste and the pain of it. With her eyes closed, she could see the taste, salt and metal, a burnished copper shining pure in the dark inside her eyes. If she vomited, she would choke. She would choke and he wouldn't notice. She would strangle and die and he wouldn't stop. She put her hands on his thighs to brace herself and dug her fingers into the heavy muscle, pushing back as hard as she could to resist the battering. He was humming deep in his throat. From Ushant to Scilly is 35 leagues. Wiry hairs brushed her lips. Then Leroy was gone. He let go of her ears and stepped back, unbalanced. She fell forward on hands and knees, gagging and coughing, the strings of saliva from her mouth tinged pink with blood. She coughed and spat again, trying to clear her mouth of foulness. Her lips were swollen and throbbing with her heartbeat. He lifted her effortlessly, hands under her arms, and kissed her, tongue thrusting, one palm cupping the back of her head to keep her from pulling away. He tasted overpoweringly of brandy, with a faint nastiness of decaying teeth. The other hand, at her waist, roamed slowly downward, kneading her buttocks. He said, sighing pleasurably.
Bedtime, eh, sweetheart?
She lowered her head and butted him in the face. Her forehead struck hard against bone, and he uttered a sharp cry of surprise and loosened his grip. She wrenched free and ran. Her flying skirt caught on the door latch and tore, disregarded as she hurled herself out into the dark companionway. The sailors were at supper. 20 men sat at a long table in the mess at the end of the companionway. 20 faces turned toward her in expressions ranging from startlement to lascivious interest. It was the cook who tripped her, sticking out a foot as she dashed past the galley. Her knees hit the deck with numbing force.
"Like games, do you, sweetheart?"
It was Bonnet's voice in her ear, jovial as ever, as a pair of hands scooped her up with disconcerting ease. He whirled her to face him and smiled. She had hit him on the nose. A thick trickle of blood flowed down from one nostril. It ran over his upper lip and followed the grooves of his smile, thin lines of red showing between his teeth, and dark drops dripping slowly from his chin. His grip on her arms tightened, but the merry glint shone as ever in his light green eyes.
"That's all right, sweetheart," he said. "Leroy likes games, don't you, Leroy?"
He glanced down, and she followed his gaze. He had shed his breeches in the cabin and stood half-naked, Leroy brushing against her skirts, quivering with eagerness. He took her by one elbow and, bowing gallantly, gestured toward the cabin. Numbly, she stepped forward, and he took his place beside her, arm in arm, nonchalantly exposing the white cheeks of his buttocks to the stares of his gaping crew.
After that, it wasn't so bad.
She could hear her own voice, unnaturally calm, as though it belonged to someone else.
I didn't fight him anymore.
He hadn't bothered to make her undress, merely untucked her kerchief. Her dress was made in the usual fashion, with a low square neckline, and her breasts were high and round. It took no more than a casual downward yank to bare them, popping them up over the edge of the bodice like a pair of apples. He mauled them idly for a moment, pinching her nipples between a large thumb and forefinger to make them stand up, then pushed her toward his tumbled bed. The sheets were stained with spilled liquor and stank of perfume and wine, and overwhelmingly of the rank, heavy odour of Bonnet himself. He shoved up her skirt and arranged her legs to suit him, humming all the while beneath his breath,
"Farewell to ye all, ye fine Spanish ladies."
In her mind's eye, she could see herself thrusting him away, flinging herself off the bed and running for the door, skimming light as a gull down the dark companionway and bursting up through the grated deck to freedom. She could feel the wooden boards under her bare feet and the glare of the hot summer sun in her dark blind eyes. Almost. She lay in the dim cabin, wooden as a figurehead, tasting blood in her mouth. There was a blind, insistent prodding between her thighs, and she convulsed in panic, scissoring her legs. Still humming, he thrust a muscular leg between her own, brutally nudging her thighs apart. Naked from the waist downward, he still wore his shirt and stock. The long tails drooped around Leroy's pale stalk as he rose up on his knees above her. He stopped humming long enough to spit copiously into his palm. Rubbing roughly and thoroughly, he eased the path, and then set to business. With one hand clutched firmly on her breast, he guided himself with the other to an inescapable berth, making a jovial remark about the snugness of the accommodation, and then loosed Leroy on his mindless and mercifully brief gallop to pleasure. 2 minutes, maybe three. And then it was over, and Bonnet lay heavily collapsed upon her, sweat crumpling his linen stock, one hand still crushing her breast. His lank fair hair fell soft against her cheek, and his exhalations purled hot and damp on her neck. At least he'd stopped humming. She lay frozen for endless long minutes, staring up at the ceiling, where the reflections from the water danced across the polished beams. He sighed at last and rolled slowly off her onto his side. He smiled at her, dreamily scratching one bared and hairy hip. "Not bad, sweetheart, though I've had livelier rides. Move your ass more next time, He sat up, yawned, and began to straighten his attire. She edged toward the side of the bed, then, sure that he didn't mean to restrain her, rolled abruptly off and onto her feet. She felt light-headed and desperately short of air, as though his bulk still pressed upon her. Moving in a daze, she went to the door. It was bolted. As she struggled to lift the bolt, her hands shaking, she heard him say something behind her and swung around in amazement. "What did you say?"
"I said, 'The ring's on the desk,' he said, straightening up from retrieving his stocking.
He sat down on the bed and began to pull them on, waving casually at the desk that stood against the wall.
"There's money, too. Take what you want."
Top of the desk was a magpie's nest, littered with inkpots, trinkets, bits of jewellery, bills of lading, tattered quills, silver buttons, ragged bits of paper and crumpled clothing, and a scatter of coins in silver and bronze, copper and gold, currency of several colonies, several countries.
"You're offering me money?"
He looked up quizzically, fair brows arched.
"I pay for my pleasures," he said. "Did you think I wouldn't?"
Everything in the cabin seemed unnaturally vivid, detailed and individual as the objects in a dream, which would vanish with waking.
"I didn't think anything," she said,
her voice sounding very clear but distant, someone speaking from far away. Her kerchief lay on the floor where he had thrown it, by the desk. She walked there carefully, trying not to think of the warm slipperiness that streaked down her thighs.
"I'm an honest man, for a pirate," he said behind her,
and laughed. He stamped once on the deck to settle his foot in its shoe, then brushed past her and lifted the bolt easily with one hand.
"Help yourself, sweetheart," he said, with another casual wave toward the desk as he went out. "You were worth it."
She heard his footsteps going away down the companionway, a burst of laughter, and a muffled remark as he met someone. Then a shift of his voice, suddenly clear and harsh, shouting orders to someone above, and the tramp and scurry of feet overhead rushing to obey.
Back to business.
It was sitting in a bowl made of cowhorn, jumbled with a collection of bone buttons, string, and other bits of rubbish.
Like him, she thought, with a cold clarity.
Acquisition for its own sake, a reckless and savage delight in the taking, with no knowledge at all of the value of what he stole. Her hand was shaking. She saw it with a vague sense of surprise. She tried to grasp the ring, failed, gave up. She scooped up the bowl and emptied its contents into her pocket. She walked down the dark companionway, her fist wrapped tight around the pocket, holding it like a talisman. There were seamen all around,
too busy about their task to spare her more than a glance of lewd speculation. Her shoes were perched on the end of the mess table, bows perky in a shaft of light from the grating overhead. She put them on, and with an even tread walked up the ladder, across the deck and gangplank, onto the dock, tasting blood.
I thought at first I could just pretend it didn't happen. She took a deep breath and looked at me, her hands folded over her stomach as though to hide it. But I guess that won't work, will it? I was silent for a moment, thinking. It was no time for delicacy.
When, I said, how long after Roger?
2 days.
My eyebrows lifted at that.
Why are you so sure it isn't Roger's, then?
You weren't using pills, obviously, and I'll bet my life Roger didn't use what passes for condoms in these times.
She half smiled at that, and a small flush rose in her cheeks.
No, he...
Oh, coitus interruptus.
She nodded.
I took a deep breath and blew it out through pursed lips.
There is a word, I said, for people who depend on that particular method of birth control.
What's that? She asked, looking wary.
Parents, I said.
Chapter 46. Comes a Stranger. Roger bent his head and drank from cupped hands.
A piece of luck, that flash of green, pointed out by a finger of sunlight stabbing down through the trees. Without it, he would never have seen the spring, so far off the trail as it was.
A clear trickle bubbled through a crack in the rock, cooling his hands and face. The rock itself was a smooth blackish green, and the ground all round was boggy, rumpled by tree roots and furred with a moss that grew brilliant as emeralds in the fleeting patch of sun. The knowledge that he would see Brianna shortly, perhaps within the hour, soothed his annoyance as effectively as the cool water eased his dry throat.
If he'd had to have his horse stolen, it was some consolation that he'd been close enough to reach his destination on foot. The horse itself had been an ancient nag, barely worth stealing. At least he'd had the sense to keep his valuables on his person, not in the saddlebags.
He clapped a hand against the side seam of his breeches, reassured to feel the small hardness snuggled against his thigh.
Beyond the horse itself, he hadn't lost much more than a pistol, nearly as ancient as the horse and not half so reliable, a bit of food, and a leather water flask. The loss of the flask had troubled him for the last few miles of hot, dusty walking, but now that minor inconvenience was remedied.
His feet sank into the damp ground as he stood up, leaving dark streaks in the emerald moss. He stepped back and wiped the mud from his shoe soles on the carpet of dry leaves and crusted needles.
Then he dusted down the skirts of his coat as well as he could, and straightened the grimy stock at his throat. His knuckles rasped the stubble on his jaw. His razor had been in the saddlebag. He looked a right villain, he thought ruefully. No way to meet your in-laws.
In truth, though, he wasn't much concerned with what Claire and Jamie Fraser might think of him. His thoughts were all on Brianna.
She'd found her parents now. He could only hope that the reunion had been so satisfactory that she'd be in a mood to forgive his betrayal. Christ, he'd been stupid!
He made his way back toward the path, feet sinking in the soft leaf layer.
Stupid in underestimating her stubbornness. Stupid not to have been honest with her, he amended. Stupid to have bullied her into secrecy. Trying to keep her safely in the future? No, that hadn't been stupid at all, he thought, with a grimace at the things he'd seen and heard in the last few months.
He pushed aside an overhanging limb of loblolly pine, then ducked with an exclamation of alarm as something black shot past his head. A hoarse "grawk" announced that his assailant was a raven. Similar cries gave notice of the arrival of reinforcements in the trees nearby, and within seconds another black missile whizzed past within inches of his ear.
"Hey, bugger off!" he exclaimed, ducking away from yet another croaking buzzbomb.
He was plainly near a nest, and the ravens didn't like it. The first raven sailed back for another try. This pass knocked his hat into the dirt. The mobbing was unnerving.
a sense of hostility out of all proportion to the size of his adversaries. Another came in, zooming low, and struck him a glancing blow as its claws ripped at the shoulder of his coat. Roger snatched up his hat and ran. 100 yards up the trail, he slowed to a walk and looked round. The birds were nowhere in sight. He'd passed their nesting place, then.
"And where's Alfred Hitchcock when you need him?"
he muttered to himself, trying to shake off the sense of danger. His voice was dampened at once by the thick vegetation. It was like talking into a pillow. He was breathing heavily, and his face felt flushed. All at once, it seemed very quiet in the forest. With the ceasing of the raven's racket, all the other birds seemed to have stopped as well. It was no wonder the old Scots thought ravens birds of bad omen. Spend much longer here, and all the old ways that had been no more than curiosities would be flourishing away in his mind. Dangerous, dirty, and uncomfortable as it was, he had to admit the fascination of being here, of experiencing at first hand things he'd read about, seeing objects he knew as museum artifacts being casually used in daily life. If it wasn't for Brianna, he might not regret the adventure, in spite of Stephen Bonnet and the things he had seen aboard the Gloriana. Once more his hand went to his thigh. He'd been luckier than he'd dared hope. Bonnet had had not one gemstone, but two. Would they really work? He ducked again, having to walk half-crouched for several steps before the branches opened up again. Hard to believe that people lived up here, save that someone had cut this trail, and it must lead somewhere. "You can't miss it," the girl at the mill had assured him. And he could see why. There wasn't any place else to go. He shaded his eyes, looking up the trail, but the drooping branches of pine and maple hid everything, presenting only a shadowy, mysterious tunnel through the trees. No telling how far it might be to the top of the ridge. "You'll make it by sundown, easy," the girl had told him. And it was late mid-afternoon now. But that had been when he had a horse. Not wanting to be caught on the mountainside in the dark, he picked up his pace, straining his eyes for sunlight ahead that would show him the openness of the ridge at the end of the trail. As he walked, his thoughts ran inevitably ahead of him, quick with speculation. And how had it gone, Brianna's reunion with her parents? What had she thought of Jamie Fraser? Was he the man she'd been imagining for the last year, or only a pale reflection of the image she had built up from her mother's stories? At least she had a father to know, he thought, with a queer little pang at the memory of Midsummer's Eve and that burst of light in the passage through the stones. There it was, a lightening of the dense green shadow ahead, a brightening as tongues of sun struck autumn leaves in a flare of orange and yellow. The sun dazzled him for a moment as he came out of the tunnel of greenery. He blinked once and found himself not on the ridge as he had expected, but in a small natural clearing, edged with scarlet maples and yellow scrub oak. It held the sunlight like a cup, dark forest spreading beyond on all sides. As he turned about, searching for the continuation of the trail, he heard a horse's whicker, and whirled to find his own elderly mount jerking its head against the pull of a rein tied to a tree at the edge of the clearing. "Well, I'll be buggered," he exclaimed in astonishment. "How the hell did you get up here?"
"The same way you did," a voice answered him.
A tall young man emerged from the wood beside the horse and stood pointing a pistol at Roger. His own, he saw, with a sense of outrage as well as apprehension. He took a deep breath and choked down his fear.
"You've got my horse and my gun," Roger said coolly. "What else do you want? My hat?"
He held out the battered tricorn in invitation. The robber couldn't possibly know what else he carried. He hadn't shown them to anyone. The young man, couldn't be more than in his teens, in spite of his size, Roger thought, didn't smile.
"A bit more than that, I expect."
For the first time, the young man took his eyes off Roger, shifting his glance to one side. Following the direction of his gaze, Roger felt a jolt like an electric shock. He hadn't seen the man at the edge of the clearing, though he must have been there all the time, standing motionless. He wore a faded hunting kilt,
whose browns and greens blended into the grass and brush as his flaming hair blended with the brilliant leaves. He looked as if he'd grown out of the forest. Beyond the sheer unexpectedness of his appearance, it was his looks that stunned Roger into speechlessness. It was one thing to have been told that Jamie Fraser resembled his daughter. It was another to see Brianna's bold features transmuted into power by the stamp of years, and fronting a personality not only thoroughly masculine, but fierce in aspect. It was like lifting his hand from the fur of a handsome ginger cat, only to find himself staring into the unblinking gaze of a tiger. Roger barely kept himself from taking an involuntary step backward, thinking as he did so that Claire hadn't exaggerated a single thing in her description of Jamie Fraser.
"You'll be Mr. Mackenzie," the man said.
It wasn't a question. The voice was deep, but not loud, barely lifted above the sound of the rustling leaves. But Roger had no difficulty hearing him.
"I am," he said, taking a step forward. "And you'll be, Jamie Fraser?"
He stretched out a hand, but quickly let it drop. Two pairs of eyes rested coldly on him.
"I am," said the red-haired man. "You'll know me."
The tone of the question was distinctly unfriendly. Roger took a deep breath, cursing his own dishevelment. He didn't know how Brianna might have described him to her father, but Fraser had evidently expected something a good deal more prepossessing.
"Well, you look quite a bit like your daughter."
The young man gave a loud snort, but Fraser didn't look around.
"And what business have ye with my daughter?"
Fraser moved for the first time, stepping out from the shadow of the trees.
No, Claire hadn't exaggerated. He was big, even an inch or two taller than Roger himself.
Roger felt a stab of alarm mingled with his confusion. What the hell had Brianna told him?
Surely she couldn't have been so angry that... Well, he'd sort that out when he saw her. "I've come to claim my wife," he said boldly.
Something changed in Fraser's eyes. Roger didn't know what it was, but it made him drop his hat and half raise his hands in reflex.
"Oh, no, you're not."
It was the boy who had spoken, in an odd tone of satisfaction. Roger glanced at him, and was still more alarmed to see the lad's big bony knuckles white on the pistol's grip.
"Here, be careful. You don't want that to go off by accident," he said.
The young man's lip lifted in a sneer.
"If it goes off, it'll be no accident." "Ian."
Fraser's voice stayed level, but the pistol lowered reluctantly. The big man took another step forward. His eyes were fixed on Roger's, deep blue and slanted, unnervingly like Brianna's.
"I'll ask only the once, and I mean to hear the truth," he said, quite mildly. "Have you taken my daughter's maidenhead?"
Roger felt his face grow hot as a flood of warmth washed up from chest to hairline.
Christ! What had she told her father?
And for God's sake, why? The last thing he had expected to meet was an infuriated father bent on avenging his daughter's virtue.
Well, it's not what you think," he blurted. "I mean, we meant to." "Did ye? Or no?"
Fraser's face was no more than a foot away, completely expressionless, save for whatever it was that burned far back in his eyes.
"Look, damn it, yes, she wanted to..."
Fraser hit him, just under the ribs. Roger doubled and staggered back, gasping from the blow. It didn't hurt, yet, but he'd felt the force of it all the way to his spine. His principal feeling was one of amazement tinged with anger.
"Stop," he said, trying to get enough breath to talk. "Stop, for God's sake, I said I..."
Fraser hit him again, this time on the side of the jaw. That one hurt, a glancing blow that scraped the skin and left his jawbone throbbing. Roger jerked back, fear turning rapidly to fury.
That bloody sod was trying to kill him.
Fraser swung at him again, but missed as Roger ducked and whirled.
"Well, to fuck with good family relations, then."
He took a giant step backwards, shrugging out of his coat. To his surprise, Fraser didn't come after him, but stood there, fists at his side, waiting. The blood was drumming in Roger's ears, and he had no eyes for anyone but Fraser.
If it was a fight the bugger wanted, that's what he'd get, then.
Roger crouched, hands up and ready.
He'd been taken by surprise, but he wouldn't be caught that way again. No brawler, still, he'd been in his share of pub fights. They were well matched for height and reach, and he had more than 15 years' advantage on the man.
He saw Fraser's right, ducked and countered, felt his fist brush linen as it passed Fraser's side, and then the left he hadn't seen took him in the eye. Bloody stars and streaks of light exploded through the side of his head, and tears ran down his cheeks as he launched himself at Fraser, roaring.
He hit the man. He could feel his fists strike flesh, but it seemed to make no difference.
Through his one sound eye, he could see that broad-boned face, set in eerie calm like a Viking berserker. He swung, and it disappeared, bobbed up again. He swung, grazing an ear. A blow struck him in the shoulder. He swung half around with it, recovered, and launched himself head first.
"She's mine,"
Roger gritted between clenched teeth. He had his arms wrapped around Fraser's body, felt the deep-sprung ribs give as he squeezed.
He'd crack the bastard like a nut. "Mine, here?"
Fraser Rabbit punched him in the back of the neck, a glancing blow, but hard enough to numb his left arm and shoulder. He let go his grip, hunched, and drove his right shoulder hard into Fraser's chest, trying to drive the older man off his feet. Fraser took a short step back and hooked him hard, but the blow struck his ribs, not the soft flesh below. Still, it was hard enough to make him grunt and jerk back, crouching to protect himself. Fraser lowered his head and butted him straight on. He flew backward and landed hard. Blood from his nose ran down his mouth and chin. With a sense of remoteness, he watched the spatter of dark red drops grow and run together into a splotch on his shirt. He rolled onto one side to avoid the kick he saw coming, but not far enough. As he rolled frantically the other way, it occurred to him, in a detached sort of way, that while he might be 15 years younger than his opponent, Jamie Fraser had likely spent every one of those 15 years engaged in physical combat. He'd got momentarily out of range. Gulping air, he rolled up onto his hands and knees. Blood gurgled through smashed cartilage with each breath. He could taste it in the back of his throat, a taste like sheared metal.
"Nuff," he panted. "No, nuff."
A hand grabbed his hair and jerked back his head. Blue eyes glittered 6 inches away, and he felt the man's breath hot on his face.
"Not nearly enough," Fraser said,
and kneed him in the mouth. He fell over and rolled once, then struggled to his feet. The clearing blurred in a throb of orange and yellow. Only instinct got him up and moving. He was fighting for his life, and knew it. He hurled himself blindly at the weaving figure, got a grip of Fraser's shirt, and drove a punch at the man's belly as hard as he could. Fabric tore, and his fist struck bone. Fraser shifted like a snake and shot a hand down between them. He grabbed Roger's testicles and squeezed with all his strength. Roger stood stock still, then dropped as though his spinal cord had been severed. There was a split second before the pain hit, when Roger was conscious of one last thought, cold and clear as a shard of ice.
"My God," he thought, "I'm going to die before I've been born."
Chapter 47. A Father's Song. It was well after dark before Jamie came in, and my nerves were thoroughly on edge from the waiting. I could only imagine Brianna's. We had eaten supper, or I should say, supper had been served. None of us had any appetite, either for food or conversation. Even Lizzie's normal voracity was noticeably impaired. I hoped the girl wasn't ill. Pale and silent, she had pled a headache and gone to bed in the herb shed. Still, it was fortunate in the circumstances. It saved me having to invent an excuse to get rid of her once Jamie did arrive. The candles had been lit for over an hour when I finally heard the goat's bleating greeting at his step on the path. Brianna looked up at once at the sound, her face pale in the yellow light.
"It'll be all right," I said. She heard the confidence in my voice and nodded, slightly reassured. The confidence was authentic, but not unalloyed. I thought everything would be all right.